thank you, Rosie, and thank you, Paul, for inviting me. This is a wonderful little venue. Yeah, that would be handy, actually, it might be. Thanks very much, sir.
Pleasure.
Okay. Andrew, should I use the mic?
Yes.
Oh, it's okay. Okay, I will. So, I'm going to read poems from my four collections, just a few from each, and then if we have time, I'll see how many I can read from my recent stuff that I've worked on, which isn't published yet. I'll start with the first collection, Airborne, and a poem called... When? I suppose this is my little vision of the apocalypse. I grew up in the 70s, so like many people growing up in the 70s, I was acutely conscious of what was called MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction. So it seems to have worked so far, but who knows how long it will hold on. So I wrote this little sonnet, which was published in the Times in 1982, I think. When the sky comes down to earth too soon, and we're woven into light's immaculate shroud, when the black light seeding all our bad dreams blooms in a spine of smoke bearing aloft the brain cloud, when one dies, and in that breath millions more are furnace-fanned to ashes that will blow wherever the winds rage, burned out spores settling out of the fuming skies like snow. When all those seeking heaven's drafty halls will find the conflagration had to spread, that angels with singed wings have fled their stalls, leaving behind the dead to count the dead. Clouds will roll back, a full moon, mirror, waste. And time do what it always does, erase. That's cheerful. I went to one of the few concerts. The first one I went to was Rory Gallagher in the stadium. That was way back in the 70s. But then in the 90s, I went to a U2 concert in the old Lansdowne Stadium in Dublin. And I was amazed. I was drawn to this. This vision in the middle, anyway, the title will explain it. Girl in a Wheelchair, Dancing to U2 in Lansdowne Stadium, Dublin, 1997. In a clearing near midfield, she is tossing her hair, waving her arms, catching hold of, taking for a wild spin, a new constellation, the chariot. The center holds. Big wheels rattle and hum, sparks fly from her. And these are very short. This is, this will be self-evident, I suppose. It's just called Advice to Adolescents. Rave to the slackly made and woefully sung, the worse the better. Be moody, unstrung for days. In love with the drum rolls of doom. Never tidy your room. you might remember Tom McGinty, the Dice Man. I wrote this poem for him because I used to love coming across him in Grafton Street. He'd always cheer you up, you know. Just seeing him in whatever guise he was wearing that particular day. For everybody know who the Dice Man is? For those who don't know, he was employed by a shop called the Dice Man to walk around as a giant dice, basically. That's how he got the name. But after that, he was street theatre, basically. He would dress up in all these numerous costumes as different things. It could be anything. So I think that'll come across in the poem. It's called Lines for the Dice Man, in memory of Tom McGinty. Good to know you might turn up in the freeze of faces on Grafton Street, familiar stranger surprising us in something from your wardrobe gallery, a walking painting, say, holding its own gilded ornate frame, the face a white mask, Mona Lisa in a black catsuit cracking a murky smile. Dead slow, solemnly careful, among eddies of Christmas shoppers, summer dawdlers, tourists, street traders, guards, mindful of each soundproof step, sure footed as an acrobat, spaced in, treading your own high wire. When we looked at you looking through us, we took in the joke that jumped, a spark of silence, eye to eye, mind to mind, across Grafton Street's canyon of swirling clockwork work noise. You're gone now forever, back into the box with Jack, and scanning the quick, slow, giddy, sedate, everyday street portrait, its procession of invisible masks, the eye misses you, old master, dice man, conductor of the ungrooved thought, catcher of the thrown glance. Are you still there? This is just called Patchouli. When I was growing up, patchouli was everywhere, and it was wonderful. I always liked the smell of patchouli, and I had a particular girlfriend at the time when I was about 17, and we both used to dress in odd ways. And she wore her father's pajama trousers tied with ribbon, and I wore hair down to my ass, believe it or not. I could hide behind my hair. We walked around together. patchouli kind of summoned up a whole era for me, summon up this era. So, patchouli. Essential oil, a viscous, resiny darkness, dark as distilled cannabis. You didn't wear it, it wore you. Filling your clothes, even whatever you touched, glasses, somebody's sheepskin jacket, each other. A disguise for hash smokers, they said. More like a signal. I followed the spore through dance halls and wild, deep purple weekends. It was all those warm, warm women I may have met who reclined on their couches, murmuring to come in from the cold, to sit over here. Okay, I got into gambling for a while when I was working in Captain America's in the 70s. It lasted about a week. I cured myself. And I wrote this poem as a result. It's called Fruit Machine. Pierre's pool hall in Stephen's Green. Bored with pool, table soccer, screeching cars. I slotted 50p, watched the prayer wheel spin. Lemons, cherries, black bars. Till it jammed on three melons, trembled slightly, and spewed. £80, more than a week's wages then, as if a whole silvery orchard shook itself and stood still, a drench of what seemed like actual luck. Till Friday, back on a beeline, thinking, screw it, a little loose change from the wage packet. They are offered. Sweet plunges, gear sticks to crest the high, shifting dunes, juicy mirages we won't reach or even want to, the aftertaste, a mouthful of old coins. Like the frosty night, I sped down Killiney Hill, took a sharp corner for a freeze-framed eye blink, hit black ice, a steering wheel spinning, a useless toy. Lemons, cherries, black bars, a trance, a trip through a hole in the world, gripping just in time to swerve from the wall. This is called The Golden Gate. I have to explain what this is. For anybody who's interested, there's an amazing essay written by Tad Friend in The New Yorker called, I can't remember the title, but it's about the Golden Gate, and the Golden Gate became, and I suppose still is, a mecca for suicides. There's about, when I read the essay, there was about 1,200 who had jumped, and of those, very, 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 very few, a handful, survived. And this guy did survive. And so this is what you call a fan poem. I just lifted his lines, literally. This is all, but this is what he wrote. I shouldn't have explained this. I should let the poem explain itself. But anyway, it's called The Golden Gate, Crossing the Cord. I instantly realized that everything in my life that I thought was unfixable was totally fixable, except for having just jumped. But he survived. That was the amazing thing. This is my, the Irish have a tradition, as you may know, of cursed poems. Michael Hartnett wrote a great one on the cursing the neighbours for mistreating his cat, I think. There's also one by James Stevens about a glass of beer. But this is mine. It's called A Blessed Curse, and it's for the human race. May your children and your children's children marry again and again he or she whose skin is unmistakably, even in a dim light, that shade that has you most affronted and afraid. And may these marriages be devastatingly happy. This is just called On My 100th Birthday. There will be time for one last night on the town, a warm lounge branching off a dark side street, and later, much later, a fleet of mist buses, unhitched lifts, to one of those all-nighters of our dreams, leaving us as we were, not quite at a loss, possessing our keyless chain to the closing city, its warren of locked rooms and washed-out stars, as if we could sing ourselves sober, as if we could talk ourselves drunk, or, after all, make tracks through the abandoned heart of the dimlit 70s, as if that was the way. Where was I? My shout. And then we'll go get ready to make a start. This is from Fade Street. And, what time are we at? Oh, we're okay, I think. We start with the title photograph, title poem, I should say. Photograph, I'm getting mixed up. It's called A Photograph of Fade Street, Dublin, 1878. Amazing photograph. It's in one of the big archives. And it made me imagine the photographer behind his tripod, the photographer who took the photograph, the anonymous photographer, because so many of those old street portraits, street photographs, they're amazing, and they use long exposures. They had to use long exposures, and of course that meant that a lot of the people in the photograph would become invisible, so they became blurs. And I imagined the photographer behind his camera, so it's kind of imagining the photographer's point of view. A photograph of Fade Street, Dublin, 1878. The exposure, half a minute, enough for a light's breath to cloud the glass with this narrow Georgian canyon, dark fan lights behind dark doors, sash windows raised, while the far end assumes its name and grays to a smoky membrane. Steady as a gramophone needle behind his tripod, the afternoon swirling about him, time's pupil concentrates on the cogs and gears. Three girls perched on a curb will be restless smears. Two boys sitting on a doorstep may take, if they keep staring, contracted in the same hard gaze as their grown-ups, two men in bowlers, huddled on the next step. Opposite, nearer, the pair of women who stand talking with a third, held sharp in her street-level window, sway themselves into ghosts with a pale-faced lad flickering from a doorway. Others, too fast, walk through the boxed walls, empty themselves up steps, withdraw, an old man tapping the pane, gone, a cat in the railings, children who whir, sparrow across the street. Let's see. Yeah, I don't know if you know Picasso's little sculpture of the bicycle seat? Anybody know that? It's amazing, it's just a bicycle seat with handlebars. And it's no, it's not. It's Picasso, I can assure you.
That's the goat looking thingy.
Yeah, it's the goat. Well, it's the bull looking thingy. It's whichever. A bull goat. Anyway, it's called, the title kind of explains it. It's called Bicycle Seat, Bull's Head, Bull Leap. Picasso, 1942. Here's an answer. Slim-skulled, playful, austere, clear as the nose to a problem no one posed. How to release the bull from the bicycle. So handlebar horns offer a leap charged with laughter. I always think Picasso is just a wonderful comedian, you know? Apart from everything else. This is kind of self-explanatory. It's called One of the Houses James Joyce Lived In Once. James Joyce lived in a lot of houses. James Joyce ivy on James Joyce plaque. James Joyce pebbles on James Joyce dash. James Joyce knocker on James Joyce door. James Joyce dust on James Joyce floor. James Joyce windows with James Joyce glass, waiting for James Joyce clouds to pass. pretty even short one. It's just called, it's my little monostitch. A monostitch, I love the name monostitch. It just means a one-line poem, that's all. So this is mine. It's called Ghost Story. Listen hard enough and you wake the dead. I don't know if you remember, there was an ad by the Atheist Bus Campaign in England. They had these big ads on the signs of buses, the sides of buses. And the title of the poem is one of these ads. And then there's the poem. There's probably no God. Now, stop worrying and enjoy your life. The Atheist Bus Campaign. Not only is there probably no God, but this is probably not your bus. The Last Wolf in Ireland. I stole this title from John O'Donnell, who had a poem with the same title, but his is totally different. So it begins with a quote from Shakespeare, As You Like It. Pray you, no more of this. 'Tis like the howling of Irish wolves against the moon. The last wolf in Ireland was hunted down, caught, and skinned like the others. Was neither seen nor heard. Was heard howl one last time at a slip of a moon, blacked out in cloud. Was never even rumoured as it skirted the nets of history and symbol. Was glimpsed once, 50 years after all wolves were declared gone, a creek in the evening, the lean mask's paler stillness between what was left of the oaks, by a horseman who crossed himself in fear or reverence or both and spoke of it to no one. Was anywhere, nowhere, a face in a folded pack, a title searching for a poem facing extinction. I wrote a series of little, they're hardly translations, I don't speak Irish, let alone old Irish, but they're departures is what I call them. I'll just read one of them, called The Hosting. The Hosting is, let's see if it comes across. It is a king's work, this hosting of all of Adam's seed, and yet it is no work, nothing at all, and it proceeds. No sooner do we know than we study to forget where the hosting goes. No one is ready yet. When you are called forth, if you refuse to leave, in whose house, whose fort, will you stand siege? And lastly, I have a little thing called Memo, which I'm not sure even I understand. But anyway, it's only a few lines. Memo. Remember the hour when a real foot stands on real earth. It leaves the print of a centaur, a whiff of horse sweat and wild mint. You might start there. So this is from my recent book. And I'll begin with Bullseye. Has anybody seen A Murmuration? Do you know what it is? Yeah, A Murmuration of Starlings. They're wonderful, they're like clouds. They change shape. Anyway, I saw something that I thought was a murmuration, but it wasn't, and hence this poem. It's called Bullseye. Spittle at dusk, in the rear view a grainy swirl over the rooftop. Starlings? That murmuration I'd hoped to witness. Swerving, pulling in, under the copse near the church, I saw what it was, rooks, their cries sharp as springs bursting from the sky's mattress, a murderous parliament, swelling, shrinking, circling the tattered wind of itself, black as the trees taking them back, coming in low so my upturned face felt the fury, and a single hard tap on my shoulder could only be that species of luck. Accuracy. If you get that, the bird shat on me. How far is out of space? This is something my son asked me when he was about 10, 9 or 10. How far is outer space? If you take a car and aim it straight up, you can arrive in under an hour without breaking the national speed limit. But first, you will need to find the right car. My broken-in grey-blue 323 with the James Bond pop-up headlights. Comfortable as a pair of old trousers, those trips when I pulled hedged-in nightscapes around me up to my hips. No CD or airbag, though you can allow your airbag mind to inflate. Fill every crevice from the footwell to the rear window. Gun the angle. Push the stick all the way into vertical. Flick on the high beams. And you're away, a bulging roar of dust in gravity's lay-by. This sequence, I'm not going to read the whole sequence, a sequence about my school days called Academic, and the title, I assure you, is completely ironic. There's two little poems I'll read you from it. First, a four-line poem just called Latin. I never learned one word of Latin in school. And this may be why, but I was also just a crappy pupil. Latin. Mr. Banks's drone could not be drier as he conjugates a mow, a mass, a mat, till a terrible drought rolls in along the Tiber. The flagon's empty, love itself gone flat. And this is French. We had a mad French teacher called Mr. Fontan, who was not from France, but anyway, there was a big scandal about him later. He died fairly recently, and he left his papers and everything, and money to a library in Wales, I think, the National Library in Wales, and they didn't want to, there was a scandal about whether they should accept the money or not, and you'll see why in the poem. So it's just called French. Mr. Fontan, fruity, isn't from France, but Brittany. Important, make no mistake. Something, anger, passion, has shorn his face to a bald, beak-nosed, hunched electric presence. Yes, he fought with the SS during the war. A Breton nationalist, why should he hide what he believes? What he did was justified, though I'm not sure who these justifications are for. The Irish, so stupid! Hard to believe how little we know. And how can we make a start when, in restaurants, we ignore the heart of artichokes to nibble at the leaves? Now he has lost patience and swoops to wrench some slow coach from his desk. I am in his sights and will be next. Because of, or despite, whatever he fled, he teaches excellent French. And this is just called, you've heard of The Falling Man? 9/11, everybody? Yeah, anyway. This is just called Of a Man Falling. At ease looking, almost poised, though his soiled shirt has come untucked, he might be attempting to pass the one-leg stand test or lounging between drinks at a party, his back braced by a wall, if the world had not turned him upside down into the plummet of street window sky, the brain in its cockpit, flight, the flight of his thought, a 10-second freight. For all we know, a counterweight. And this is a little poem about my mother who died a few years ago. It's called Sips. My mother needs to drink 3 jugfuls of water, which is just as difficult as it ought to be when your 93-year-old bones are spiteful with arthritis, osteoarthritis. Just keep taking small sips, I say, though I know well that in this desert water's far from ambrosial. If I lifted the sky, blew off the sand like dust, I'd uncover her, stooped over a stream, water dark as the unruly hair falling in her eyes, while she cups handfuls, deliciously cold after the climb above some hazy post-war city, Munich, Belfast, Rome, whose busy streets have no room, no corner, for a 54-year-old son who keeps telling her to take small sips. funny peculiar, that I, the class dunce, got bored enough in maths to actually attempt the sum which Mutor Mora had warned us was difficult, and found, to my amazement, the formula began to work, a knot magically unpicking itself. That, 5 years later, dropped out, dandering with a friend, along the edge of a little wood, a place we often came to, we heard, then saw them, two men, striding towards us, like farmers across a field, jackets and ties in the long grass evening, carrying, here I might have blinked, what appeared to be guns, a machine gun cradled by the older, limping one, while the younger, steadier, held what looked like a handgun. That when we asked for the answer and no one possessed it, and I half raised a tentative hand and gave it, she demanded coldly, "Who did you copy that from?" That when we heard the man with the machine gun growl, "I'll fucking kill you!" it moved us to make for the trees, but not too fast, since evening, still breathing evenly, might be persuaded to hold its peace, its pace. That neither I nor anyone else challenged Mutor Mora, though I dreamed of seeking her out, loading and aiming that point-blank memory between her eyes. So I went back to being what I probably would have been anyway, for the rest of my school days and some time beyond. And now she is safely dead. And now she is safely dead. That before they told us they were special branch, security for the British Embassy, whose patch we had been trespassing on, when the cameraman shoved my head hard against a tree, twisting long hair, pressing into my temple the steel nub, but he frisked, showed how it felt to be felt up by death. It put me into a skin, a voice that could ask coldly, "What are you going to do with us?" This is, oh yeah. I squatted in London for a while in the 80s, actually. Just when the wall came down in Berlin. So this is called High Rise Squat, 1989. A crowbar, that was the thing. As if I was prising the lid off a crate rather than climbing into a crow's nest for a stowaway. Across the channel, the street party to end all parties, Berlin was tearing itself together. Go over and see. I kept my head down, stayed in. Fixed a great plastic sheet in the smashed window. Days that sagged at peace or wind, rain, sleet, snapped and rattled my sail. Found a girlfriend instead of my feet, so no need to pull up my socks. 6 months, a blink, an age. Skies packing and unpacking, while the blocks stood around us like luggage. How are we doing? Is that half an hour yet, or?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So I will finish with one poem that I've been working on, which is more, I suppose, notes than a poem. Okay. It's called two poems, fine. Okay, two poems. Then I'll finish with that one. So I'll start, tell you what. I'll read your ballad, shall I? Mm-hmm. I only ever wrote one. Does anybody ever hear Father Noyes? No? Anybody? Nobody?
Never.
Father Noyes.
It's the guy who fell into the lake.
That's right. Father Noyes is a makey-up person. I think it's brilliant, actually, because there's a plaque to him on O'Connell Bridge, and he's completely fictitious. And they wanted to remove it, but they couldn't. They took a vote, and I went to the meeting, and they've kept it. So you now have a plaque on O'Connell Bridge, proper plaque, to a person who never existed. And that's what the poem is about. So it's called The Ballad of Father Noyes. When I saw the ghost of Molly Bloom, she wasn't on her own, but arm in arm through the Dublin gloom with the ghost of Molly Malone. Then a third one passed between them, a man of the cloth, no less, and he raised a hand as if he meant to say hello or bless. Did he help poor Peter Clancy? Was he at the GPO? Did he hang out with the IRB? No one can ever know. For Father Noyes was born in brass, two brothers dreamt him up, a name on the bridge where crowds push past children with paper cups. Dublin has its passing souls, its ghosts of flesh and blood, the new maps laid across the old, the cart ruts in the mud, and some names enter history with a flash and a mighty roar, and some waft in like a summer breeze and leave by the back door. But here's a name that should be sung, a story yet to tell, a rumor tested on your tongue until it rings a bell, and we raise a glass to his little plaque, the storyteller's cause, to the shadow man, the man in black, the man who never was. And lastly, these are, we got a dog in the family recently, a mad little Jack Russell called Lola. It made me extremely conscious, because we were a cat family for about 30 years. So this was a big change. And after the, you know, apart from the birth of my son, this was probably the biggest change in the family. So it's just a little series of comparisons. So it's called Notes on Cats and Dogs. Tree equals wall. Tree equals staircase. The tail is ever hopeful, metronome, propeller of delight. The tail is a seismograph, warning, whipcrack of furious silence. No matter how small, a dog has bulk and is earthed. No matter how large, a cat treads 1 millimeter above the ground. A dog is proof against intruders, wind in the chimney, ghosts. A cat is partly an interloper, partly its own ghost. A dog abandons itself to the chase. If it runs fast enough, it'll spread wings. A cat's wings are folded into the crouch, the stalk, the pounce. A cat delicately sniffs the air, a leaf, a grass blade. A dog delicately sniffs the air, a leaf, grass blade, before being yanked, snorting, to the center of the earth. A dog on its back, the ultimate submission. A cat on its back, maybe. Proof rocks, predicament. He is a dog, she isn't. In the wake of the dog, opportunistic campfires, tossed bones, tradings of scent, the slow, painstaking deciphering of the human face. In the wake of the cat, settlements, palaces, a niche for a household god. A dog fills a space. A cat opens one. Thanks.